Cachimbonas, welcome to season 6 of Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast of the audio archives, state repression, and fierce migrant resistance in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. As a daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. This is a special lit review that I'm unlocking. I have gotten a few new patrons ever since I reminded you all that this is an independent podcast with no ad space, and that really without the contributions of the patrons, I cannot continue to podcast with the frequency that I have been and that I want to continue doing. And so this is a lit review that I did around 3 years ago, but everything we talked about is still relevant and it still hits, as the youth say. The lit review is a book club for Cachimbonas. It's a place where I put out a list of books that I'm going to read for that season and discuss the text with other women of color. And on this lit review, I brought back Jehan Leiner Romero to discuss the book of short stories, Funeral for Flaca by Emily Prado. We shared which aspects of Prado's life as a Chicana Latina growing up in California mirrored our own, broke down multi-generational fat phobia, and appreciated the rawness with which Prado shared her childhood traumas. If you want to support the podcast, please become a patron. For as little as $3 a month, you'll get access to the whole back catalog of lit reviews. There's literally dozens and dozens of episodes that you can check out, and it's for as little as $3 a month. Again, if you become a patron, you are allowing me to continue doing this work in these times of increasing fascism, reliable voices, reliable media sources, just reliable sources in general are diminishing, and it's all the more important to support the voices that you trust in this moment. It's one way that you can fight the rising fascism. So the link to join the Patreon to get more access to reviews just like this one will be in the episode show notes. I hope that you all enjoyed the episode. If you want to support the podcast but you are unable to do so monetarily at the moment, you can also leave an Apple Podcast or Spotify rating. Thanks to the anonymous listener who rated on Spotify. Thank you everyone for giving me a 5-star rating. Please share what you like about the podcast. It helps me maintain visibility and gain new listeners. You can also follow at Radio Cachimbona on Instagram, X, and Facebook to continue the conversation there. Thanks to Grant Bloom for the intro and audio editing as usual. Hope that y'all enjoy this episode. Bye.
Sick, so hopefully I don't start coughing on this recording.
I'm also sick. I'm recovering from COVID. I did get it 2 years in. It feels like so much longer. I'm like, is that really how long it's been? It's only been 2 years.
But since like the shutdown, closer to three.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's, yeah, no.
And then
end of the year.
Yeah, and then, like, it came out, like, dropped in November 2019. So, yeah.
Dropped.
For, like, close to 3 years. Yeah.
So, if my voice sounds weird or if I sound stuffed up, that is why. And I think that this just shows my true dedication to this podcast. So, I hope that this inspires somebody to become a patron.
Yeah. but yeah, we want to give shout outs to everybody else to rest from their jobs when they need to.
True. We're not setting good examples right now. I don't have anyone in my life that's a good example of like not working while sick. Like my boss works while he's sick, while his kid is sick. Joseph also works when he's sick. And I feel like American work culture, you know, United States work culture is like really fucked up in how much it expects of people, and working when you're sick, I think, is one of those.
Yeah, so true. I'm trying to think if I have a good example. I don't, but but yeah, we should try to turn those tides and stop working when we're sick.
We are here today to discuss Funeral for Flecka, which is a book of short essays by Emily Prado. But before we get into that, Jaehan, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm always so honored that you want to talk to me in general.
Well, that's not true because you don't always text me back, but
that's just a problem I have in life. It's not about you.
Are you an air sign?
Oh yeah. Hard air signs all over.
Oh god.
I'm an Aquarius and I've got a lot of Libra, so yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you guess we'll all forgive me. Yeah.
We'll let that slide.
I was literally, before you asked, I was about to say I'm an Aquarius. It's just part of the territory.
I asked you to read this book because it's written by Emily Prado, who is a Chicana who grew up in the Bay Area, and she kind of talks about her experience growing up as a Latina woman in a predominantly white suburb of the Bay Area, which is Belmont. You live in the Bay Area now. You're a Latina yourself. And I felt like you'd be able to relate to a lot of what she talks about, even though she did grow up in the Bay Area. Like there are some similarities between growing up Latina in the Bay and in LA like you did. So thank you for joining and giving me your perspective.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no, I'm really excited to talk about this book. I also grew up in a little suburb of LA. I will say I was lucky.
You grew up in Whittier, right? But isn't that predominantly Latinx?
That's what I was just going to say. I was just, I felt really lucky because my high school, was mostly Latinx. So
yeah. Belmont, it's like a very like, it is like an upper middle class, wealthy, like white area. Mm-hmm. And I think she talks about how her parents moved there for the public schools.
Yeah.
So.
And she kind of alludes to her dad having like some maybe not fully legal businesses that allowed them to move up there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Or like maybe not fully on the books, I should say.
It's none of my business.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is a collection of essays, quote, about traumas, the way our bodies, communities, and brains respond. It's a book of essays and short stories, and each is the title of a song. And that actually is very fitting because Emily Prado is actually a DJ as well as a writer, which is the coolest fucking thing. And she made a playlist of the essay titles. And so it's like, she says that project is the project itself is like part mixtape.
Yeah.
And the stories follows her metamorphosis starting with her childhood in Belmont, California. And she says, I hope it gives you nectar to the reader. And I feel like it did.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried to listen to each song at the start of each little essay that she had.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Just to keep
it. Were you surprised by any choice that she made?
I was keeping a really open mind because I felt like I was getting to know a person. But yeah, as it like started happening, I was like, oh, okay. I didn't see that coming. And like, I feel like I'm getting more of her. Like I didn't expect, she talks about going through like a punk phase or some of that I didn't expect. And so it was kind of cool.
Yeah, I actually love that. I love that she went through so many archetypes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And then and some of the more poignant moments, and I think I relate to this too, of the book, she really uses music to get through things. Like when her tia dies, that played like a pivotal role. And so I was like, yeah, it makes, I understood where she was coming from with that. Although I am not a DJ or anything musically creative.
Yeah. She challenges the misogyny imparted on her by her family, especially her dad, a lot.
Did you see that in the various essays too?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and she seems to be around our same age too. So just a lot of the trends that were happening when she was growing up, I was like, I totally remember that.
Definitely, like fat phobia of the 90s.
Everything. Yeah. And so I feel like had to go through some of those societal like misogyny that is always placed on us and like how she grew past it or dealt with it. And then also just like on a more familial level, coming from Latinx families and some of those expectations that are also put on us from our families.
Mm-hmm.
I think with her dad too, particularly, a lot was going on because he, it seems like, was pretty blatantly disrespectful to her mom. And so I think,
yeah,
like she had to deal with that as well.
It just seemed like he didn't fully step up to the plate. And she talks about how that lack of recognition led to feelings of inferiority. And she, to draw out like the misogyny in our families that you were talking about, she discusses how her dad tells her that elders are deserving of undying respect.
Yes.
And it's quite a self-serving statement if you think about it. And I appreciated her being so raw about that.
Yeah. And I feel like, I don't know about you, but I feel like I've heard definitely in my own Latinx family, like some form of that. Like,
either. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's like, why it's just important to bring it up, because then it's, you know, I just want us to have healthy boundaries.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And that can't happen when the central notion that unites you as a family is that because you are blood related, nothing can come between you. It's kind of, it's like a ticket to do whatever you want.
No, exactly.
When placed in the wrong hands.
Exactly. And I think, yeah, that's something that we all end up working through therapy, right? It's like, okay, now how do I set this? Yeah, yeah. Like, how do I set this healthy boundary now when I've been told, like, oh, it's because I'm your mother, or it's because I'm whoever, like, I get to tell you or say this hurtful thing to you, but it's because I'm your mother. It's coming from, like, a good place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her dad had a whole other family that he prioritized, and then, like, when his ex moves on and has a baby with another man, he's trying to cut the baby out of the inheriting the house.
Yes.
Because he says, quote, he helped secure it for his kids. And I, like, the audacity of that was mind-blowing to me, but thought, you know, found it really heartwarming that for her that was just a moment to like strengthen the bond that she has with her half-sibling or her sibling. You know, I feel so weird about the half-sibling thing. Like, I find the terminology a little offensive.
Yeah. In my family, my mom's generation, there's technically half-siblings, but no one considers them. Everyone's just brother and sister. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. No one, I mean, sorry. Yeah. No one considers them like to be half
or
to be
less than. Really important.
They consider them to be like, no, they consider them to be brother and sister. And like, my mom, that's like a thing she always says. She's like, I only have brothers and sisters. I don't have like half whatever.
Yeah. But that's definitely like not the case. And I feel like her dad expressing that was, because it's also like a weird thing about biology and genes.
Mm-hmm. Like that get tied to these people, even though you're not going to actually have much of a relationship, like they end up living in different states. Yeah.
Right. No, exactly. And, you know, it was like, I think she does discuss how her dad was an emotional void in her life. And so it's just very ironic that like he has constructed this idea of them as a unit in his head.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're right. It's like a self-serving thing because he doesn't like try to help out in an emotional or like being there for you supportive way. I kind of allude to him like maybe sometimes giving them child support and maybe when he's upset, like withdrawing it. But yeah. And I think you're right. Like she starts out the book, I think it's with a story about her dad, or like one of the first two stories is about her dad. And then like pretty quickly he ends up.
Yeah, it's about her dad disappointing her. I was like, oh God, it's going to fucking resonate.
Yeah. And then like pretty quickly, like she ends up saying like how he ends up leaving their family. And so it's kind of sad to see like how much he, when she was a young girl, was like a source of support. And like, it's somebody who it seemed like she could be closer to. Yeah. Yeah, because he disappointed her.
Well, yeah, because like that first initial story, I felt like was about probably was about one of her core memories and maybe mm-hmm. one of the earliest times that she remembered her dad betraying her. Mm-hmm. Because like she is so she's little, she's like, I don't know, in kindergarten, first grade, and they're doing show and tell, and she like. I guess they have to like choose everyone gets assigned a letter and like mm-hmm. you have to like bring an object or person whose like name starts that. So they got D and they're like, oh my God, we're going to pick our dads. And it was like her and her friend that coordinated it. And she like takes us through her mental process mm-hmm. and she like, cause she asked her dad like, hey, can you come to the show and tell things? He's like, yeah, sure. And I guess didn't really think about it or didn't really prioritize it. And then it's heartbreaking because everything is from her perspective. So you're reading it as though like this show and tell thing is like the most important thing in the world. And the thing is, because it was the most important thing in her world at the time. And her friend's dad shows up and then her dad doesn't. And still, though, the story is her like, holding out hope that her dad was going to be there. She's like, no, like, my dad's reliable. Like,
yeah.
That was what was heartbreaking to me about that story. And I think she put it there at the beginning because it's pretty emblematic of mm-hmm. the relationship that she tells us about later on.
Totally. Yeah. It like sets up, foreshadows what happens later. But I think it was really sad too, because it seemed like right before all of that, she seems to talk about her dad in the way of like, we were the unit, like me, him, we were like, you know, like he had a special relationship with her. And so I think it makes it even more like sad for her when he ends up leaving them too.
Yeah. I guess that's why because she talks about how, like, her teacher started looking at her with pity.
Yeah.
And, like, the other kids were like, dude, it's not happening. We got to move on. And how she, like, clung on to that. And it's, like, she clung on to that because she had that foundation that she was wanting to have. Mm-hmm. She also discusses racialized desire in the book and how that was central to her understanding of self as an adolescent girl growing up, girl of color, growing up in a predominantly white place. Could you relate to her experiences of being forced to, quote, try on these various pre-molded identities? Like we talked about how she dresses a punk, but then also a chola and then preppy and navigating whether that aligned with the acceptable parameters imposed on you when you're coded as Latina.
Yeah, I think we probably all relate to this at some extent because you try to fit in. It's middle school. I think it's definitely middle school. Like you try to fit in with what's cool. And when we were growing up, it was like, at least in LA, it was like Abercrombie. Like this was like what would be like popular mainstream.
Parts of LA, right?
Like, No. I was just going to say popular mainstream because people also ended up going to like switch out to different of these subsets, but like popular mainstream, it was like, still like, you know, you want to be a blonde surfer person.
Yeah,
that was like, this is mainstream. And so everybody else was like, if I can't fit into that, I need to deviate away from it or then like figure out what my little circle was. So I definitely remember being like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to look like. And like trying to like get to that.
Yeah.
But, I actually had a pretty strict mom. Like
she didn't let you dye your hair blonde.
No, I didn't want to do that. But like she,
well, how are you trying to achieve this?
No, I couldn't be into like any like variation of anything. Like if Hollister was like too short, like those types of things, or like if I wanted to be punk, like that wasn't okay. Or like she wasn't okay with like hooded sweatshirts.
Wait, did you dry though?
Oh yeah, like I just wanted to fit in. She wasn't okay with hooded sweatshirts because. Yeah, she was like, you're gonna get mistaken as like gang affiliate or something. So like,
oh my god,
very neutral like Gap type of clothing. But I remember the like me thinking like this is like not cool, like no one dresses like
I think that she did a good job of capturing like how experimental aesthetic is when you're in middle school and how, yeah, the world that you're navigating gives you these preconceived modes of being, and that it's like weird when you're Latina and you're in a place that's predominantly white. Mm-hmm. It adds an extra layer of, it's distinct.
Yeah, it's an extra layer of like, you're not ever going to fit into like what is like, what they're saying is, what they supposedly are saying is like the status or like whatever that is.
Right.
Where did you grow up, Yvette? Can you remind me?
I grew up in Pacifica. So I I know actually, I'm still working on scheduling the interview with Emily Prado, but I feel like I really need to because we're really going to understand each other
when we speak.
Because Pacifica is actually pretty similar to Belmont. You could argue like it is predominantly white. It's definitely not as wealthy as Belmont, but it is like a middle class place. And I experienced like everything. This book, I was like, wow, this book was like written for me.
Yeah, no, I was thinking, I knew you grew up in NorCal and I was wondering the whole time. I was like, what? Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of my friends that grew up in NorCal, but came from like not the wealthy area, but ended up going to like a wealthy school.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of talk about, like she talks about in high school, like ending up with drugs and things like that. And my neighborhood, like, of course there were drugs and alcohol, but like in my neighborhood, not the same amount of access to drugs, because there is just higher access when you're in a wealthier area. And so I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like that is what I've heard from people who go to wealthier schools. Like there's just like access to those. It's a weird combination of like both not fitting in a certain way because of your racial identity, and then also like having access to these things that come with wealth too.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. Because Pacifica is like it's like a weed town. And yeah, like I remember being in high school and like smoking weed in like a school parking lot, and if I was Black and in a different place, like that could have ended up very badly for me.
Yeah,
you know, doing that exact thing. So yeah, I think there's definitely like, even if you are ostracized as a person of color, like, you know, there is also the possibility of gleaning at the periphery of whiteness its benefits.
Yeah. And then also just like internally, like she has to like deal with, and I'm sure you did too, but like deal with like this internalized thing on a personal level that your peers aren't dealing with.
What internalized thing?
Like just, she was internalizing a lot, like, oh, well, and people were telling her this, and this is why she's like internalizing it, but telling her like she's too dark or her nose is too big or like, and so she starts to internalize, okay, like, well, I'm ugly, or like, even though she's definitely not, like every time I looked at a picture of her in the book from like, you could tell her this when you talk to her, but like from 6 to like now, I was like, wow, she's so beautiful.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's like you just start to internalize those types of things if people keep saying them to you like all the time.
Yeah, that's a good segue to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is that she discusses eating disorders a lot and body dysmorphia and how fat phobia is an ideology that's taught early.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about being in third grade and already knowing and being conscious of how much food she ate and to make sure that it wasn't more than what the quote growing boys were eating.
Mm-hmm.
How does she show the ways that these are deeply gendered issues in that space?
Yeah. And like, I think growing up when we did, I'm like hoping Gen Z isn't dealing with this as much, but like, yeah, all the celebrities were just like super, super skinny. And she talks about that. I think there's like so many ways that it was like gendered though. Yeah. She talks about like the girls commenting on her in a good way when she started losing weight. She talks about the celebrities like Nicole Richie, and I forgot who the other person that she mentioned, but I remember them too, because like it stuck in my head, like, they were like uber skinny, and like that was like if you look at the picture now,
Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears,
yeah,
like
Yeah, you look at them now, and, like, I'm not trying to, like, judge anyone's body, but you're like, okay, yeah, that was probably not something we should have idealized to teenage and preteen girls.
Yeah. Or just among anybody. Like, I feel like if you're that skinny, you're unwell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, like, yeah. And I really do remember all of that. She talks, and, like, even the nickname she was given, which was Flaca in the title of the book.
but, like, yes, it was, like, given funeral for Flaca.
Yeah. So like, yeah, I think a lot of it goes to her being a woman and, like, how women's bodies are policed, and as a girl, actually. Yeah. How girls' bodies are just up for discussion in a way that I don't think men's bodies are. And, yeah, like, the little boys, when she was little, would, like, talk about her body too.
Yeah. Because it's, like, normal for boys to grow. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's definitely gendered. She also discusses working through being an assault survivor and being an abolitionist, mm-hmm, which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
She feel like she really definitely criticized restorative justice, and I think actually makes an argument for transformative justice. Can you break down the differences between the two and how she did that?
Yeah, I mean, I might need help with the breaking down the definitions, but
yeah,
this part of the book was, you know, I feel like there's been a lot of discussion in the last couple of years, especially around these topics. And so I feel like I've done my own personal processing about it, but I felt like even a deeper sense of healing just reading her story and the way that she dealt with it. But yeah, so she was talking about a situation in which she was raped and how she came to understand it as rape.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like what people see in, like, SVU, where, like, you're walking around at night and a stranger grabs you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, like, a person that she went on a date with, and then they didn't listen to her. She did not consent, and they just kind of kept going with it. And she had the experience of, like, kind of, like, freezing and not being able to stop, right, or, like, put a stop to it. Maybe she couldn't have either way. I, like, also hate, like, saying that you have to put a stop to it, because I don't know that, like, you fighting is also necessarily going to save your life or, like, save you from whatever's about to happen.
Yeah. And, like, what we should be striving for is enthusiastic consent, not, yeah, like, oh, you know, I didn't hear her say no. Like, yeah, she looked really fucking uncomfortable the whole time, but yeah, she technically didn't say no.
Yeah, exactly. And in this case, it was, like, pretty, she, like, said no a bunch of times, or, like, had told him, like, I don't want to have sex, like, a bunch,
yeah,
of times.
Yeah.
So definitely not enthusiastic consent. But this person was also a person, I can't remember if they were white or not. I think they were, but they worked in, like, the nonprofit spaces that she was in. And so they were, mm-hmm, I believe, also a person that had access to, like, youth and, like, yeah, interns, yeah, like maybe, like, people who probably shouldn't be having access to. Yeah. But, like, so in the future, she's, like, working through it, and the boss of where he works asked for her support because she's in media. So, like, asked for her support for something. And the way that she handled it was just talking about, like, I always said that if I needed to support him, if I was going to end up being asked to support him in any way, like, I would be really transparent about what he did and why I couldn't support. So this is why I can't support this org. I thought that was a really good way. And then, to the ED's credit, or, like, the executive director of that org's credit, they, like, actually seemed to, like, want to know more. They weren't the best, because they were also kind of like, he's leaving in a year, so, like, you can still support since he's going to be gone. But so it's, like, a mixed bag there. But they were kind of asking Emily what she wanted to do about it, if she wanted to, like, kind of come forward and do a call out.
Mm-hmm.
And I've definitely seen call outs in, like, a lot of the spaces that I've been in.
Yeah.
And Emily had a really nuanced take about, like, it doesn't necessarily work for the victim either, or the survivor of the action. Like, oftentimes, mm-hmm, it ends up that they get backlash and scrutiny. And, like, mm-hmm, it is a really brave thing to do. And, yeah, it's a really brave thing to do. And, like, you do want to warn people, especially if someone is in a position of authority, of women or youth or whoever, actually, like, you know, they can, mm-hmm, be a predator in multiple ways.
Yeah.
She brought in a friend who had, they had also found out that she had been sexually assaulted by the same person. And they ended up kind of just sharing their story internally with the org rather than, mm-hmm, doing a call out. And so the person did get dismissed, and they did do an investigation. I have, like, two more parts on this. Like, the one thing that I thought was kind of healing for me, something that I hadn't really thought about before, was she talks about after two sexual assault experiences, or like, I can't remember if one ended up being, or if it was just going the in a dark way where someone also wasn't listening to her consent, she actually tried to go on a date again with somebody who seemed like a really, really nice person and who like checked a lot of boxes for her in general. But she was just scared to open up herself to another man at that moment, just because of like, you know, feeling vulnerable and afraid. And I've like never thought about like how like sexual violence has affected me in that way. And I'm like, yeah, that's totally happened where like I've shut myself down in like a protective mode from like even friendships or anything else, just because, yeah, like you're. And so it was just like a whole part of like this gendered violence that I hadn't even thought about, like that happens to people who have suffered it. It's just like, yeah, you shut yourself down from like friendships or interacting with other people. And she talks about even shutting herself down from like just people who hadn't had that experience. So that was just like another thing that it was kind of healing for. She put words to a lot of things that I hadn't heard before, so it was like good to like have a person talk about that. And then the differences between restorative and transformative justice. So I am like having a hard time defining the difference between them, because I think of restorative justice as like, we're not turning towards the criminal legal system for this. We're going to take the two parties that have been harmed and bring them in, sit them down, but there has to be consent between both parties. And like, where the goal is that the person that was aggrieved gets to say like what happened to them, and then the person that perpetrated this will like listen to them and hopefully like take accountability and learn from it. Transformative justice, I'm not quite sure, but I feel like what was cool with what she did was like it didn't really need him in the process. So like that I thought was really cool. But I don't actually, yeah, if you want to tell me more about transformative justice.
The critique of restorative justice from people who advocate for transformative justice is that it embedded in restorative justice is this idea that we are going to make people whole after this injury has occurred, or that we're going to, or, you know, we're going to return to the status quo before harm occurred. But the thing is that doesn't interrogate what about the status quo led to that violence in the first place. And so transformative justice does try and look at those underlying things and tries to find solutions from that vantage point.
I like that. I've always heard of them as like the same. So it's cool to like know about what the difference is.
Yeah, I think it was Joseph that told me about this, because one time we like a flipping comment. I was like, "Oh my god, restorative justice, isn't that so 2005?" Yeah, it always. And I was like, "What?" Yeah, and I think like I don't remember at all where I read this, but I feel like I was reading an example that was like, "Oh, for example, like if somebody like tags an old lady's car." Yeah. Like restorative justice might look at the solution as like, so this person's going to like repaint the car or like buff the car so that the spray paint is gone.
Yeah.
But then like transformative justice might look at like what in your neighborly bonds broke down that like felt like it was appropriate to spray paint an old lady's car.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, I think transformative justice is a hard one because you obviously have to get the perpetrator of harm on board. But I think, like you said, it's still cool, though, because I think from the person who's harmed perspective as well, like transformative justice ultimately tries to focus on their healing as well. Like, what do you need moving forward? Which is the example that she gave of like, I don't need a public call out where that's going to like cause public scrutiny onto me. And I actually just want to, in this safe space, like tell you what happened and have it validated in that way. And that's a really important perspective because survivors currently that's like not treated that way by the criminal legal system. It's like the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like people are, you know, forced in many ways to to testify or to abide by the legal parameters. And I think a transformative justice approach like gets us away from that, you know, from trying to think about this as like adjudicating a dispute between two parties and mm-hmm. yes, looking at the harm itself and trying to understand the harm itself, but also transforming the individuals involved such that maybe in the future that harm wouldn't happen again.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great distinction. And definitely both of those, I think, are way preferable to the criminal legal system because...
Yeah, but I feel like we should be choosing the best
system,
alternative, you know.
Definitely,
so. Yeah.
No, 100%. Yeah, just saying, like, it's really awful. I'm still coming from, like, the immigration context where a lot of survivors have to get any relief. They do have to go through the criminal legal system and mm-hmm. just, like, seeing how it re-traumatizes them as victims or... that they're just not believed in the first place or that it opens them up to even, they're black and brown people. So they can also get punished in different ways, even if it's not about that incident, it opens them up to exposure to the criminal legal system too. So, yeah.
Yeah. She references this essay that's called A Survivor's Case Against Restorative Justice, but then I couldn't find it. So I don't think it's online anymore. I hope somebody's archiving the internet.
Yeah, somebody is. But yeah,
we're losing a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
you know, because there's some, especially
when Tumblr left. Sorry,
especially when Tumblr left. Yeah, because she references an essay about a survivor's case against restorative justice, and I was like, oh, like, yeah, actually, even though I hope I did an okay job of explaining the two differences, like, I actually myself would like to learn more about these distinctions. So I was, like, trying to find it and then couldn't.
Oh, yeah, so, I just found the, like, blog it's supposed to be on, but then you get the 404 gateway.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Okay.
So she tries to imagine accountability and then, like, opens up about how she has a hard time doing so. What does accountability outside of the prison industrial complex look like for you?
Like, personally or?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, it's, like, the second half of,
well, like you, but then also, like, in, like, as we were just talking about, you know, we're getting rid of prisons. So what's the alternative? Like what, like when we, cause people are going to harm people. So what do we do in that instance?
I got you. Yeah. God. Yeah. That's a big question. I don't think we need to like solve it for every situation in one beat, but I think definitely accountability is like acknowledging the harm that you did first. And then like, being able to state concrete ways that you're going to make sure that either like you don't perpetrate that again or making it so others don't. Because I think that's truly when you like understand that you show that you actually understand. Like, because you can say sorry all day, but like if it's just gonna be something that you go on to do or like you're just saying sorry to shut somebody up or like move on. Like that's different. So I think it's like you actually putting forward some type of work to either show that you're not going to do it again or that you're going to help other people understand who might be like at risk of doing those same actions of like why they need to not do that. I'm thinking particularly like in a friend of a friend group, someone was a perpetrator and did something bad and their accountability for their friends was like, that person went to therapy to like unearth or like examine themselves about like what led them to do that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like for them to keep a job or like to get out of court proceedings. Mm-hmm. It was just something that their friends made them do.
Yeah.
And then their friends like had like this accountability group that had nothing to do with like the survivor. Like it wasn't on the survivor to do this, but like their friends would like check in with him and like ask him like what he was doing. Was he following the therapy like recommendation? And it was like a specialist, because there's specialists too when you're like depending on what you've done. Like, so I mean, I thought that was a good model, because it's also like I also work with people who are perpetrators, and it's hard, it's really hard too for like, it's hard for me to work with them because, like, you,
yeah,
it's, you can't really, I don't know, it's hard not, you are judging them. So, like, it's hard for them.
But I actually, like, really like that people
get
that
the support.
The survivor isn't involved and that mm-hmm. it's this individual's friends that are holding them accountable, because that is 1000% what we need. Like, yeah. This victim perpetrator binary makes it so that when someone is accused of harm, like, the knee-jerk reaction is to dispose of them and to totally. Ostracize yeah. them and to be like, well, guess we're not friends with that person anymore. Like,
yeah.
And
like, to be clear, that person lost a lot of friends too.
Okay.
And yeah, like, you know, it's,
I mean, yeah,
it's, also have consequences.
That's fine too.
And that's like, that's another way of holding somebody accountable of like,
yeah, exactly.
I'm going to withdraw my like relationship with you. But like, it was like that person's very, very close friends that were like, yeah, yeah, I'm going to be in your life and I'm going to hold you accountable. And they did. And like, they had really tough conversations with that person and like, yeah.
Yeah, like, because I feel like, one way that abusers do get away with harm is, like, convincing a subset of people that yeah. they are, quote-unquote, good people. And, like, by, like, it's, there's this expectation that their kindness to others, like, cancels out the harm that they do to others. And I feel like holding your friends accountable is, like, actually the hardest thing. Like, it actually is easier to just cut off a friendship, and I'm not saying that the people that cut that person off like did something wrong.
Oh yeah,
everything is a case-by-case basis, but like, I think all of us need to get more comfortable with the idea that our friends perpetrate harm.
Totally. Yeah. We know people who have, and like, we care about them. And like
and
you
we,
said, yeah.
And we care about them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like, I feel like that's just like way more, that is transformative.
Yeah. Actually, I just realized I have this book and I haven't read it yet, but it's by Adrienne Marie Brown, the mm-hmm. We Will Not Cancel Us.
Oh,
and Other Dreams of Transformative Justice. So I literally have this book, but I haven't read it yet. And I've been, specifically with that situation I was telling you about in mind, like, there were not any models. Like, people reached out to me, like, as someone that, like, has clients who are perpetrators of, like, well, what do we do? And I'm like, there are really, like, no resources, like, just from my Google yeah. searching for, like,
yeah.
how do you hold somebody accountable as, like, a friend and not in a, like, the only model we have on, like, a society-wide scale is, like, cancel. Like, when I say cancel, I just mean, like, stop talking to that person. Like,
yeah.
yeah.
Which is an offshoot of the prison system itself. Yeah. Because, mm-hmm. like, the idea of sending someone to prison is confirming this understanding of them as disposable.
Yeah.
Like,
and I do want to, like,
be thrown away.
Say that I'm not using this word in like the way that like the right wing is saying, like, oh, you're canceling people, where like I think yeah, like the heart of accountability might be like deplatforming you if you have like a broad platform yeah. to say hurtful things. Like, I think that's not necessarily disposing of someone. It's like, yeah, we're
no, definitely not
a consequence. Yeah,
I mean, you mm-hmm. know,
I think we're talking about like yeah in our communities. Yeah, in yeah. our communities. Yes, and like, and I'm not talking about, like, you know, this celebrity that's going to be fine because he's super wealthy anyway, but, like, he's going to get more jobs, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that's why I always say, like I prefaced all my comments by saying that I'm not saying that the people that dropped this abuser are, you know, did something wrong.
No.
Because everything is a case-by-case basis. Like, I feel like we can only show up for people insofar as it doesn't like harm us.
Totally.
And so that's why I feel like it's just really difficult, you know, to say like you should or you shouldn't keep that person in your life.
Right. And like, and for some people, like, you aren't that close with them to begin with, but it's like
yeah.
your way of holding them accountable might be like, okay, I'm not going to try to hang out with them anymore. Because, like, you're not close enough to have these in-depth conversations.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's totally fine too. Like, I went to this Imagining Abolitionist workshop and someone was sharing about how they give so much of themselves all the time. Like there was a scenario that was like, your cousin's friend is makes fat phobic jokes, but like your cousin still wants to stay friends with them. Like, what would you do? And then the person was like, we were just talking about various strategies. And I was like, I would just ask my cousin not to bring their friend around.
Yeah.
As like a boundary for me, just because I can't like if my cousin wants to have people like that in their life, then I can't control them, but
yeah.
I can control my space and who comes in it. And I don't want that person around if they're going to make statements like that.
Yeah.
And then someone else was like, you know, I just give so much of myself. Like, I feel like I would be down to like talk to the cousin's friend and like figure out where the fat phobia is coming from.
No, I mean, like if you have the space, mate, go for it. Like, but yeah.
Well, she was like saying, she was sharing in the sense of like being self-aware of knowing that she does too much.
Gotcha.
And that yeah. she like pours into others' cups too much, such that like her own cup is empty. Yeah, it's situational, but I do think like yeah. as a principle, we should strive towards that of truly acting out that we don't think anybody is disposable. And I really think that getting away from the victim abuser binary is a way mm-hmm. to is a way forward with that. Like just even recognizing within yourself that you have harmed people and that you likely will continue to harm people.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you have been hurt yourself. Like that being true within you is true of everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. Taking the church, you bet.
So one of the, oh my gosh, this okay, this might it's gonna get a little intense, but she says
that wasn't
I know it's a little extra. She said, I want to know what parts of me are evil. Mm-hmm. She said when she was discussing her ancestry.com results, because her racial background is European, African, and Indigenous American.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, she's talking about her own specific genetic situation, but I feel like this is also a part of the Latinx experience, actually.
Totally, yeah.
Apart from this individual example of that. How did you react when you read that?
Yeah, I think story? I think this is something I've definitely given a lot of thought to as well. Like, just having ancestors on all sides of like colonialism and the ones that are like probably most silenced, or I should say like I know the least about, are probably like my Indigenous ancestors because of like genocide. So yeah, I think I was just like having a similar like, or I recognized a lot of like my own thoughts in what she was writing about. And like again, like the commitment of like knowing that history that you have within yourself too, of like, yeah, what are you doing to stand up for like Native folks or brown folks, Black folks that still are here, still alive? And I think, yeah, those are like my main thoughts whenever I think very deeply about this.
Yeah. She said, I want to know who my ancestors were. I'm also too afraid to ask. And I really resonated with that one. I think especially being a light-skinned Latina, it just is inevitable that you do have some, I have some European ancestry of some sort. And yeah, it's kind of like, I don't want to know about that. Like,
yeah.
after my childhood growing up in Pacifica, which is predominantly Caucasian, and where it was communicated to me my whole life that I am not white. Like,
yeah.
She talks about that too, about how the ancestry results say that she's actually majority European. She's like,
oh, totally.
Like 60% of her lineage is European. And I think that, like she says, like, how am I going to explain this to white people in Belmont?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about the US.
She said it nicely, but. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's the whole thing about race in the U.S. and, like, how the U.S. specifically has constructed race is, like, even yeah. though like technically like yeah we're white Latinos and like if we go to Latin America we'd be considered white, like you come yeah. here and you're like it's like no I really felt around that.
At work someone recently admitted that they didn't know that white Latinxes exist.
Sorry, I just did a head tilt, like, huh?
but I think because they're when they were a Caucasian person.
No, I get, yeah, I 100% knew that was a Caucasian statement. But, like, still confused.
I know it was actually kind of it was like kind of wild how it all went down because actually they admitted this like. In front of the whole staff. It was like an old staff meeting. And a white Latina was like, I don't know, she was just explaining her identity. And then someone was like, oh yeah, I learned something new today. Like she was talking about her identity and I learned that you can be white and Latinx at the same time.
Yeah.
All right. But I brought that point up to say because like this individual is white, but actually like I would be cool with them joining the like mm-hmm. person of color affinity group because they had an accent and like in the US like you
yeah
that is enough to racialize you
yeah, like exactly.
especially in the Arizona borderlands.
Yeah, I think I've told you about this but I think we've talked about this before but the LALSA at my school, the Latino Law Student Association affinity group, like almost all of them were white.
Yes.
Like more white than me, like white blonde hair.
Your dad is white.
Yeah, exactly. That's more what I'm white. Saying. It's like white.
Or, you know, like no, no, no.
No. That wasn't in my
No, this yeah, we have talked about that because that's the exact same thing at Stanford Law. And mm-hmm. that's why I need to read this book called Elite Capture, which is apparently about how like you know, these, like, the anti-discrimination laws of civil rights movement have been captured by, like, elite
yeah.
rich people. And
totally.
I'm like, yeah, dude, that's totally what's happening at the top law schools.
Yeah. There's, like, I think we've also talked about this before, but Las Venas Abiertas de America Latina, like, mm-hmm. a lot of us had to read it in college by Eduardo Galeano. He talks mm-hmm. about this, like, dual identity of Latin Americans where, like, we have both indigenous black and like European ancestry and like what that means for us, like even though like, you know, we weren't around during colonialism, like we carry all these like scars basically of it.
Yeah. On both sides. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. That reminds me of another book that I have to read, which is called My Grandmother's Hands. Mm-hmm. And yeah. And it's like our bodies carry these memories.
Yeah.
And they represent these histories. And that's why we get asked, like, where are you from?
Totally, yeah.
Because they're like, you're evoking a specific historical moment. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Totally.
Yeah. She argues that colonization stays steady conspiring, keeping our roots buried. How does that happen?
So many ways.
I think
it happens on like the interpersonal level, like we were talking about, like she talks about when she's in Michoacan and even people who like will point out their Spanish heritage or whatever, so yeah. like it's still in like that like interpersonal like oh yeah. this is like the more desirable way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it starts like that where people are like, okay, this is what is aspirational and this is what I need to like strive for, and this is the part of me that I need to bury and not use. And so yeah, you keep striving for like whatever, like, you know, whatever the American dream is, or like
whiteness.
Yeah, whiteness, or exactly. Whereas like I think people are on a more societal wide way, or especially with climate change, I think are like starting to finally say like, oh yeah, like our indigenous folks actually had like a really good stewardship relationship with the land. And like, mm-hmm. we're still using it as human beings and like cultivating it or extracting from it, but in a more sustainable way. And like
yeah.
realizing what was there, but colonialism doesn't look at that. Like, and capitalism mm-hmm. tied into that, like isn't looking at that. It's just looking for like how you make profit as quick as possible and not really caring about those other parts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does healing look like to you? And does it align with how she describes it? She describes it as permanent protection.
Mm-hmm. I really liked it when she said that. I don't think I had, when I had thought of healing, it was kind of like, I'm not fixated on something anymore. Mm-hmm. Like it's mm-hmm. not coming up all the time, but yeah. I like her idea. So that's like how I was defining it for myself. But I like how she describes it as permanent protection, because it's like, that means that you actually have like dealt with, you know, whatever crack in your history, like mm-hmm. that problem, like hit and really festered down into, it means like you've patched that crack. You found where it was and like you,
yeah,
you know how to keep it safe, and not in like a way of like you're repressing anything, but like, yeah, you know what to look out for. It's like, you know, which boundaries to set for yourself now, or like, yeah, you know where, what is a healthy thing for you to do or not do.
I actually didn't like that. And now that you said it, I like it.
Tell me why you didn't like it at first.
Well, I just don't think that
it's permanent. That's a hard word.
Yeah, permanent protection to me evoked these questions of a brave space versus a safe space, and you know how like the people that are like, that suggest that a brave space is more accurate are like, you know, if we're going to be having tough conversations about like race and sex and class, like I actually can't guarantee that you will feel safe all the time, but like we can try and strive for a brave space where we lay these issues bare. I'm picking up what you're saying about how the permanent protection is like the repairing of the shattered glass, because it's about having the coping skills necessary such that like when you are confronted with harm again, you can cope. And I think like that's an important thread to draw out in abolitionist thought. It's like, we're not naive about people and no. their interactions and how we harm each other. And we're not advocating for like an alternative utopic bubble reality where that is true. And yeah. So I'm like, permanent protection, like, I don't know if anybody can give you that.
No.
But or like, I don't know if I don't think the universe can give you that.
Yeah, like humanity is suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. But I know it's like, oh, it's kind of a bummer. No, I feel like I like your read on it more. It's more generous and it feels true.
Yeah, I think the
Wait, when you said you were gonna stir a pot, I thought you literally meant you were gonna drop something controversial.
Oh, so not literal, figurative. I'm chatting
Wait, what with the vet.
I'm chatting with the vet because I really needed to go stir a pot that was overflowing. And she thought I was about to say something hella controversial on here.
Like, oh no, she's literally stirring a pot.
No, literally. No, yeah, I think in that phrase, permanent is a hard word, because I think it does, harm will happen, like you said, always. And I often feel like once you've like, quote unquote, like learned something or like learned how to cope with something, that like situation is like a test. It'll come back again in like a different.
Yeah.
This is so. Yeah,
the permanent but I feel like hopefully. The coping skills are like a shield that you use against it. And mm-hmm. it's not to say that the shield can't get broken or the totally. Shield won't get dented or rusty. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea of like these coping skills as a form of shield that you always have.
Yeah, exactly. No, totally.
Okay, well, that was actually my last question.
You ask such good questions.
Oh my God. Thank you.
And I like how you tie them into like all the big questions of our times.
Thank you. Oh my God. Somebody sees what I'm doing.
No, you do it. Yeah, you do it so well. Yeah. Yeah. I want to be like, I want to have your syllabus. So just tell me whatever books you're reading. And I, even if we're not doing lit reviews, just so I can, yeah, learn more.
I know. I want to, I am jealous that you're a part of a book club in the Bay. Like, I want to be a part of a, I want to be a part of your book club.
Well, yeah. All right. Let's do it.
Well, is it in person though?
No.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, it's so good talking to you, Matt.
I know, it's really good talking to you. Okay, so I end these lit reviews by asking, what is something that is inspiring you lately?
Honestly, the rain.
Ooh, love it.
Yeah, it hadn't rained. Well, maybe I just hadn't been here in a bit when it was raining, but for me, it hadn't rained in a long time. And we had like the real raindrops rain where it's like coming down, you can hear it. And I love that. And so I've just been making cozy food, and I made a rain playlist today. Probably because of Emily too. I think Emily inspired me with her playlist. And I really liked how it came out. So
I know.
It's been inspiring me. How about you?
It's kind of hard. Literally been quarantined. I'm still quarantining my home office.
Oh my gosh, that's so, there's like such isolation in that too.
So I during my quarantine, I did binge a ton of Below Deck Med, the Bravo reality show.
Oh
yes. And I actually like really like how the people on that boat approach work, because it's so different to how I approach work. Like, I was like, oh, well, I mean, okay. I have to preface this by saying actually a lot of people that work on these boats do have familial money, and that is how they got into yachting. But like, you know, as a first gen,
they're bootstrapping up their yachting. Sorry, I'll stop. Go.
Okay, wait. So, you know, I just thought about, obviously, I think about jobs in the way that everybody thinks about jobs, which is to make a living wage for yourself. But like, most of these people like joined the staff on these super yachts because they wanted to travel the world. And like, that is one kind of lucrative way to do it. Yes. Oh my gosh. They get such huge tips for like 2 to 4 day charters. Like, and like a lot of people, you know, they'll do like a season and then they'll go travel, and they'll do a season and they'll go travel. Wow. And I'm just like, what an amazing way to see the world. And
oh,
like, you know, to like travel and see the Mediterranean and all the beautiful places there. Like,
what's the show called? Below Deck?
Below Med. Deck Med. Yeah.
Cause why med? Are they medical?
No, because they're in the Mediterranean.
Oh, it's the Mediterranean. Okay, yeah. I'm like, wait, is it medicine on the yacht?
But Captain Sandy hears a lot about safety. Oh,
okay,
so cool. Actually, cool. That does come into play.
So is it inspiring you to travel or hustle in like a new way? Or like, what are you thinking?
It's inspiring me to travel more, for sure. Oh. Although, getting COVID,
I don't want to get home.
Like, actually, I like just traveled. I need to stay home. Oh God.
Yeah. I hope you heal quickly and like it doesn't.
Today's the first day I feel better. Like, I feel like a normal person again. And last night I had food cravings like normal for the first time. So
had you,
I'm
lost
on the
some
mend.
Of, like, your taste before?
Not my taste, but my appetite.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Always had taste.
Okay, I'm glad. No, I lost my, not that everyone cares, but I lost my taste and smell for one day. And I couldn't eat because I didn't realize how much you need to taste to get the texture of mushed food down your throat. Like, you know what I mean?
Oh my God. Have you seen Andor, the new? Oh my God.
Yes, I love Andor. It's so many topics.
I know. It's so good. Okay. That's another one that I'll also recommend. Below Deck Men is like really super and kind of mind numbing, but like.
You need that too.
but
yeah,
Andor,
every episode,
really
like
good.
Okay, I don't want to spoil, but like we have to talk about Andor one day because like they bring in so many themes, like private prison.
Yes.
It's
yes.
So good. Yeah.
No, and they have a thing where like they have a hose where they like That's how they get nutrients. And it made me think about that, because that's kind of essentially what your food was for that one day.
Yeah. And I was such a baby. I know people are like actually dealing with like pretty long-term effects, but.
I know. Actually, my sister's smell and taste hasn't fully come back.
Jesus.
Yeah,
this is not a good one.
Okay. Well, see, now I'm like, oh, I want to travel. And I'm like, bitch, like, you're going to take people's smell and taste along the way.
No, you're going to travel when you're healed and you're wearing masks.
And actually, you know what? I do like the idea of some quick money shit. Like, they're making, like, what I make in 2 weeks in, like, a few days.
And I like that idea of, like, yes, it's grueling when they're out on the seas and, like, you know, they're like, kind of stranded. But then they get a lot of time off to spend that money.
Yeah, so. They do. No, they do. Yeah, like, they do work hard during the shredder season, but then there's, like the winter months or, like, there's, like, certain months where it's like off season, I guess, for the richies. So like that's when you can go travel and stuff, and like a lot of people, that's what a lot of them do. And
that's awesome.
I'm like, what?
I like that. All right, below deck med, cool. Yes. And or a discussion later, just in our free time.
Okay, well, Jihan, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I'm glad we finally made it happen.
Oh, thank you.
And hopefully our next one will be in person.
Oh my God, I would love that. Yes. I'll let you know when I'm traveling to Arizona.
Okay. I mean, hopefully you come for non-work-related reasons.
Oh no, it's always work-related, but...